I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear aired earlier this year, but I thought the topic fit in nicely with the show I did last week on the 9/11 alleged hijackers and with what's currently happening in the Middle East. If you heard last week's show on the alleged 9/11 hijackers, their anomalies, and how the official account of their involvement in 9/11 falls apart when you look just below the surface, you might keep that in mind as you listen to this show. Also, at the end of the show, I'll be giving information about an upcoming movie event on July 23rd, 2015. So let's begin with this interview with Michael Springman. Today I'm joined on the show by former State Department diplomat and author Michael Springman to discuss his recently released book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View. Michael Springman was assigned to the U.S. Visa Office in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in the 1980s, which was heavy with CIA influence, and where he was repeatedly asked to issue visas to very questionable characters. When he questioned the practice and refused some of these visas, he was reassigned and eventually fired. After 9/11, he reported this situation to the FBI, some members of Congress, and several other government offices, but nobody wanted to listen. I met with Michael Springman when he was speaking at the Valley Forge 9/11 conference in, I think, 2011, called Treason in America. He's struggled over the years since 9/11 to make sense of why visas were being given to clearly unworthy characters. And this journey has led him to writing his new book called Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View. Michael Springman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I'm pleased and honored to be able to talk to your listeners.
Could you tell us a bit about your background and what led you to writing the book Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View?
Well, my background briefly is that I had worked for the federal government for something more than 20 years. I had worked initially for the Commerce Department's International Trade Administration and hadn't gotten trips overseas to Germany, to Stuttgart as an economic commercial officer, and then to India as a new foreign commercial service officer, as commercial attaché in the American Embassy in New Delhi. I eventually got into the real foreign service, and as a reward, I was sent to Saudi Arabia, to Jeddah on the West Coast, and later on to Stuttgart again, as political economic officer. And then my last assignment was economic officer at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in Washington, D.C. Since then, after the State Department fired me, I went to law school, became an attorney, and do a little bit of everything from visas to family law to collections to essentially general practice.
So, Michael, I understand that ever since 9/11, you've been trying to get people to listen to your story. You've filed many FOIA requests, even went to court. You've written many letters to government agencies, but have gotten nowhere. And this led to your deciding to write the book. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I said, all right, I got enough here to put something together. And then I thought and looked at the news and said, you know, I sort of got the impression these guys were recruited as a cadre. Because Joe Trento, the journalist, told me once I was out of the State Department and met him by chance, that what they were doing was recruiting people for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. And I said, ah, that explains everything, but it doesn't explain why they were so secretive about this. This is years later. What have they got to hide? People know about this now. So I began thinking, you know, they got this cadre, and I saw what had been done to Iraq and to Yugoslavia and to Libya and what's going on in Syria now. And I said, well, you know, I think these guys were recruited and kept as a paramilitary army, if you will, a group of terrorists that they can be aimed at and turn loose on a country the United States didn't like. So I started doing research. And the more I looked, the more this came together. And I said, this is what they're hiding. I had one good contact who said, I don't know anything about this myself, but I think that you're getting the stonewall from these people because this is still going on. And Joe Trento told me pretty much the same thing. So I started looking, and I saw that these people all had training in Afghanistan. They had been trained in Bosnia. I found out that besides running these people through Jeddah, like Joe Trento told me, there were 52 recruiting offices in the United States, including one in Washington, D.C. But no more information than that. I think that's probably the subject of another book, if I can ever nail some of this stuff down. And as this went on, I began looking for people to talk to, because I felt even saying this and proving it are two different things.
To gather information for the book concerning this cadre of militants being trained by the U.S., Michael Springman contacted many knowledgeable people concerning the Middle East who were not U.S. government supporters, but even they wouldn't talk to him.
Why do you suppose this is that none of these people would talk?
Well, it's everything from not really knowing who I am to being concerned about their name would be in print and it might do something to their chances for another job or advancement somewhere. Or they may have been told by government officials not to talk about this. They were certainly well-connected enough to know what was really going on and didn't want their names on the dotted line anyplace. And then some Arabs have told me that people from the region don't really want to help anybody unless they see some advantage in it for themselves. So it could be one or the other, or maybe even all of the reasons I've just named. So I eventually found enough information off of various websites, the Wayne Madsen Report, Michelle Chasudovsky's Global Research up in Canada, the Washington Post, New York Times, a couple of European newspapers like The Guardian and some others. And I began to put this stuff together and try to draw a clear pattern and a clear line of time and action from what happened in Afghanistan to what happened in Yugoslavia and to Iraq to Libya and to Syria. And I found that a lot of the people were basically fanatical Muslims that the American government had recruited. And Cheryl Bernard, who is the wife of Zalmay Khalilzad, the Afghan-American who was ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, and the United Nations, she said there was no way of getting the Soviets out of Afghanistan unless we get the wildest, craziest, most vicious people going to fight them. And from what I could see of the recruitment from the various groups that fought in the countries I've just named, they were all wild-eyed, over-the-edge Muslim radicals, many of whom were Arab, and they had Soviet money behind them. They had the assistance of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, which helped the Saudis in training and recruitment and organization. And the American CIA and the Israeli Mossad were also in there working with these people. And I managed to get a phone conversation with Bob Baer, the former CIA case officer. He said this was done for plausible deniability. They wanted to keep this secret and didn't want to tell the wild men they were recruiting that the United States of America was really behind it all, or the Israelis for that matter. And they all thought that they somehow found their own way to Afghanistan and Yugoslavia and the other countries through watching it on TV or getting it off the internet or something like this, which sounds totally bizarre to me.
So people were coming then through the office where you were at in Saudi Arabia, getting visas where they didn't really qualify, but getting visas to come to the U.S. to be trained here?
Yeah, right. They were sent to the CIA training facility near Williamsburg that's called The Farm, and to various military bases in North Carolina, and many involved with SEAL training.
And these guys became Al-Qaeda, what we know as Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a brand name. They were Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Then it became Al-Qaeda when Osama bin Laden and a lot of the people from Afghanistan went to the Balkans to overthrow the Serbian government.
And how about ISIS today? Are they just the next progression of this?
Yeah, another brand change. You can't keep fighting the same group over and over because people wonder why they haven't been destroyed with American air power and American money and so forth. So it's basically the same crowd, same fanatical Muslims, same Arab countries, either sending them as recruits or financing like Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states.
And now you call this, in your book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, you call this foreign policy a train wreck. And you say that the origins of this come from under President Truman in 1947 when he created the NSA and the CIA.
Exactly.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Back in the 1940s, people had the idea that if they had a decent intelligence service, instead of a catch-as-catch-can group of military service intelligence agencies, they wouldn't have another Pearl Harbor. And they created the Central Intelligence Agency in the late 1940s, and they created the National Security Agency at the same time. And Truman initially didn't like the idea. And he thought, well, maybe this would become an American Gestapo, German secret police under the Nazis. He thought that this was not something the United States should be doing. And the Secretary of State, a military man, Marshall, also told Truman this is not a good thing to do. These people are taking away the function and the control of the State Department and the Armed Forces, the War Department, away from civilian control and putting this into some kind of mysterious underground organization that may or not be controlled. Certainly Nazi Germany, Hitler couldn't even control his domestic intelligence service. He had wanted American prisoners of war killed, and German counterintelligence service said, no, we're not going to do it, and successfully hid them and successfully dodged Hitler's direct orders.
Similar to that, here you say that the CIA and the NSA operate without executive, legislative, or judicial control.
Exactly.
And you say that in the book also that the CIA is deeply connected to domestic law enforcement, which is illegal under the laws of their creation. And you say they do this through the fusion centers. Could you address that?
Right. Well, the fusion centers were set up after September 11th to get more information and to watch more people. And it was a connection of not only the CIA and the NSA and the FBI, but local police forces. You had joint terrorism task forces set up. And they've gotten to the point now where they've been given a mandate by the president to go and investigate just about anybody they find suspicious, and they go and they collect all the records they can possibly find for them, either in the American government or out of it.
You also have a section in the book about Osama bin Laden. Could you tell us about his connection to the CIA and who he worked for?
Well, he was recruited by the CIA to help with the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. He used his father's connections. His father and the bin Ladens, the whole family, had a lot of businesses in Saudi Arabia. They sold everything from cars to construction equipment to actual construction, where they would build buildings and dig holes and things like this. And he got a lot of this stuff moved to Afghanistan, and using the expertise they had in the companies to make fortresses and underground bunkers they could use to fight the Soviets. And, of course, he was trained and given a lot of advice from the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, and what do you know about his involvement or lack of it on 9/11?
Well, I don't rightly know, because the Americans blame him for it. But then on the other hand, I've seen things that said that Osama bin Laden has been charged with many things, but never masterminding the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
Right, right. This FBI has said they have no evidence linking him to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand his CIA name was Tim Osman.
That I don't know. I do know that this guy, John Schindler, wrote a book called Unholy Terror about the recruitment of fanatics for the Yugoslav War. Schindler is a right-wing neocon type. He's a former NSA analyst. And he says flatly that a lot of the people involved in 9/11 were involved with this, what I call the Arab-Afghan region, the people who came out of Afghanistan as well-trained Mujahideen terrorists, and they worked to overthrow the government of Yugoslavia. And a lot of these people were involved in that, and they were also involved in planning the September weapons issues.
Well, that's really curious to me, because if Schindler is a neocon, as you say, there's lots of evidence that the neocons were the ones who actually orchestrated 9/11. So it would make sense that Schindler would want to point the finger at the Muslims and away from the neocons. Even the efforts in Congress to release the 28 redacted pages of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 seems to be an attempt to throw the Saudis under the bus and divert attention away from the real perpetrators.
But that's another show, I guess. Let me ask you, during the whole Yugoslavia mess that happened back in the 90s, I guess it was,
mm-hmm.
I was not very political, and I believed whatever the government was telling me. And so, mm-hmm. But now I've watched the movie Weight of Chains about that. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't.
It's a very good movie about what we did to break up Yugoslavia. But you mentioned that in your book. So we took these people who got illegal visas through the Jeddah office and perhaps mm-hmm. elsewhere. And I know you have a chapter in your book about this. Could you just talk mm-hmm. about that briefly?
Sure. A lot of these guys were moved into Yugoslavia. They had the services office, the Maktab al-Khidmat in New York City, in the Al-Farouk Mosque, the Al-Kifa Center. They worked to train and recruit people for the Afghan War, and they also worked to overthrow the government of Yugoslavia. They had established an office in Bosnia, and they fed money and people into that. And there were mysterious flights of airplanes into Yugoslavia, what was then Yugoslavia, with fighter escorts. And when people asked questions about it, there was one guy, Ivan Moldestad, who was a captain in the Norwegian Air Force, who flew helicopters. He said, you know, what's going on? I saw these airplanes come in, and he called NATO offices in Vicenza, Italy, that handled a lot of the air traffic, and said, this is what I saw. And they said, no, you didn't, and hung up on him. He was taken up to the fifth floor of a hotel balcony by some American officers and said that you really shouldn't be doing this because things can happen to you. But money and weapons and fighters poured into Yugoslavia from all over, masterminded by the CIA, working with the Iranians, of all things. At one point, they were flying plane loads of weapons and things using Iranian transport aircraft. Additionally, they had close connections to all of the European intelligence services. The Germans, for example, one of the people who supposedly was a mediator was really head of the German External Intelligence Service, the Bundesnachrichtendienst. And the Germans were shipping weapons into Yugoslavia for use by people fighting the government, the Arab Afghans, in packages labeled humanitarian aid supplies. So it was a collection of really bad people who were given NATO intelligence, who were given training, and who were helped in setting up a lot of these, what you call, false flag exercises, where supposedly the Muslims were attacked in a massacre by Serbian forces when it actually was the other way around. The Muslims set up an explosion and blamed it on the Serbs.
So they used these false flag operations to destabilize the country, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Just as had been done, for example, in Italy in the 70s and 80s, where people were going around blowing up train stations, saying, you know, these are left-wing communist agitators, when in fact it was the Italian security services backed by the Americans doing it.
Yeah, that's Operation Gladio you're referring
yep.
to?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're saying these same people that were used as Al-Qaeda have been transported from Yugoslavia, then they were taken to Libya, Syria, and I think Iraq also?
Yeah, right. They went to Iraq after Yugoslavia, but I'm inclined to think that they're still working in Iraq.
Yeah.
But in Libya, for example, this guy, Belhaj, who was part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, he was a member of Al-Qaeda, and he worked to overthrow the government of Muammar Gaddafi. And suddenly, in a country that had the highest measure of any kind of standard of living in all of Africa, you had fantastic amounts of arms and terrorists flooding into the country, and nobody asked, well, where they came from or why they were flooding into Libya all of a sudden. But he was running a government that really questioned what the United States was doing, questioned what the British were doing, and questioned and lectured American government officials like Tom Lantosh, the congressman who was firmly in the pockets of the Israeli government, saying, look, you're bringing terrorists into the country, and we're trying to shift them back to where they came from as fast as we can catch them. Why don't you people do something about it? And this automatically put him on the outs with the American government. And when Obama was elected president, he reversed any kind of help that the Bush family had put together for aid and things for Libya. And he simply froze Gaddafi out of everything. He wouldn't meet with him at a summit in Italy. He wouldn't meet with him when he was invited to celebrate the anniversary of the revolution that overthrew the king. And, you know, at the time, Gaddafi was pretty much beating these terrorists that were imported by the British and the Americans and the Europeans and everybody else, and had driven them into the eastern section of the country, and it was a couple of weeks away from ending the whole mess when the Americans sent NATO in to bomb the living hell out of the place. And then they began shipping the weapons that had been collected in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi to Syria. They were sent out in 600-ton batches by shiploads, sometimes to Turkey, sometimes overland, sometimes flown by Saudi and Air Jordan aircraft into Turkey and into Syria, with the help of Jordan, who provided bases to train a lot of these people to fight Bashar al-Assad. You know, he may not be the world's best leader, but he certainly didn't destroy the country like what's happening now. This came from outside sources.
Yeah, and so you're saying that a lot of the foreign intelligence agencies work with our CIA to carry this out, these operations out around the world.
Yeah.
In the book, you also mentioned that they work together to do sort of psychological operations online by going to blogs and websites and trying to disrupt mm-hmm. things. Could you talk
sure.
a bit about that?
Well, they do that. I mean, I see what they've done to me and what they've done to the investigative journalist Wayne Madsen. They have a Wikipedia article, for example, on the internet that essentially says he doesn't know what he's talking about and he has a sketchy background and this, that, and the other thing. And in my case, they put up like two sentences at one point years ago and didn't really say much more than I had been critical of the State Department for authorizing visas for rather sketchy people. And now that I've written and spoken out more on this, they've added a few more sentences to talk about, well, you know, he really didn't know anything because the State Department said a consular officer has the final approval on a visa application, neglecting the fact that I was indeed a consular officer.
So all of this foreign policy with all of these wars that are being orchestrated by the CIA and their intelligence community friends around the world, how do they pay for this? I mean, this is costing a fortune. How do they pay for all of this?
Well, it's American money. The CIA has a budget that nobody knows how big it is. Their budget comes from appropriations given to other agencies. For example, the National Security Agency is part of the Defense Department. And they get a big chunk of money there, so you never know how much money goes for arms and ammunition or for the army in Germany. It really ends up in Fort Meade in Maryland, where NSA is headquartered. Additionally, the Saudis are putting a lot of money into this, as well as the Gulf states, especially Qatar. In addition, some of the groups that are fighting the government, any government almost, like IS or ISIL, Adil Shamu, who's an Iraqi-American, was speaking at the Palestine Center one day and said that, you know, these guys are also getting money because they were selling oil for $25 a barrel when the going rate for oil from Saudi Arabia or anywhere else was $100 a barrel. So they're making money that way as well.
And also, I mean, it's coming from the U.S. Treasury, so we don't have money for health care and for all these other things, but we have all this billions and trillions for these wars.
Yeah.
Okay, now, the media in our country is supposed to be investigative and checking power, right, executive power. And you talk in the book about Operation Mockingbird and how they're not doing their job. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Sure. Well, Operation Mockingbird goes back to the 1950s when the CIA set up an arrangement with a number of prominent journalists like Walter Pincus, who's still with the Washington Post, and Bed Bradley, who was with Newsweek at the time, who then became editor of the Washington Post later on. They basically got them to plant stories. They got them to slant stories. They were basically the propaganda arm of the CIA. They wanted to slant something a certain way, and they got it done.
How pervasive do you think it is to have sort of CIA agents working in the mainstream media?
It's outrageous. And the mainstream media is basically a bunch of corporate shills for government and for their sponsors that pay them money, and they don't want to rock the boat. Bob Perry, the journalist, had a book out a number of years ago whose name escapes me at the moment. But in the book, Perry had talked about his experience breaking the news on Iran-Contra when he started writing about a plane that was shot down and suddenly there was an American guy who had been in the army in it and the plane was full of weapons. And he did the basics for leaking the story that the CIA was trying to overthrow the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. And lo and behold, he lost his job with Newsweek. And then he had trouble getting a job in the mainstream media. He started writing on the side. He'd gotten a job with Bloomberg News, and he's running a website and writing books at the moment. But he went into great detail about how the news media worked for the government and for the corporate sponsors. He talked about a meeting one time he had had at Newsweek with higher-ups in the company and with people from the American government. And they said, well, you know, we want you to change the focus of your story. And then we think that saying it this way makes it really look bad. And if you put it another way, then things look a lot better. And he said, I'm a journalist. My job is to tell the truth without any shade of color or varnishing it to make it look shiny and new and hide the warts.
You say in the book that as a career official in both the Commerce and State Departments, you saw these plots close up, these plots around the world. And if you saw them, would you say that many others that work in the federal government saw them too? And if so, why aren't they saying something?
Well, I would think they did see this. I make a point in the book. One thing I'd like to follow up on sometime is that if I could see all these questionable visa applicants coming to me, what about the experienced immigration officers at the port of entry? Couldn't they say that these guys really had no ties to their country or place of application? And why was suddenly a clerk in a grocery store wanting to go to the Grand Canyon or to go to the West Coast or something like this? Or the guys that couldn't name the trade show on automotive parts and accessories or where it was being held. Couldn't they see this? Now, I think they were either told to shut up or they felt that this looks like trouble and it's not good for my career if I blow the whistle, because people who blow the whistle become unemployed and unemployable.
Right, and I know you've had that experience firsthand.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me, with what's happening between the U.S. and Russia, we seem to be very aggressive toward Russia, baiting them, making them look bad in the media. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of your experience?
Sure. From what I've seen, the Americans are deeply involved with overthrowing governments, you know, these color-coded revolutions that John Kerry seems to be denying now. But in the case of the Ukraine, they were involved in this Orange Revolution that pushed out a pro-Soviet or pro-Russian leader and replaced him with somebody who was more tied to the U.S., who had been educated in the U.S., and were horrified when they were bidding to encircle Russia by splitting Ukraine away from it. There's sort of a natural tension between the Ukraine and Russia because Joe Stalin had controlled the country very restrictively and killed a lot of people. But in the case of Ukraine in the present day, they overthrew the government, they forced out the leader, sent him packing to Russia, and they said, well, he was trying to engineer a deal with Russia that was better than the deal we had with Europe. And the deal with Europe was basically going to bring in a wave of unemployment and a wave of cost-cutting, which would make life miserable for the people in the country. And as long as they can weaken countries around the Soviet Union or Russia today, as they've done in the past, they keep advancing NATO, for example, up to the edge of the Russian border, and they have American troops at the Russian border, and they're sending American troops into the Ukraine. But the whole idea is to get regime change in Russia and find a leader more amenable to capitalism in the United States and to provide outlets for American goods and services and to, again, crush the economy of Russia.
So it's the same plan all over again.
Yeah, they're getting more successful at it. They did it in Yugoslavia and these other places. In the Arab world, they have the Arab-Afghan Legion. In Ukraine, they don't seem to have anybody more organized than Pussy Riot. But they're still destabilizing the place. They've rounded up a bunch of neo-Nazis, apparently, from their flags and the statements they've made to fight on behalf of the illegitimate government in Kiev, and are horrified that the people in the East are Russian-speaking and feel more of an affinity with Russia than they do with a bunch of neo-Nazis out of Kiev.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with former State Department diplomat and author Michael Springman. His new book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View, was recently released. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of this interview. And again, you are just listening to a rebroadcast of the first part of an interview with author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman. And now for the Progressive Movie Night coming up on July 23rd, 2015. We'll be showing the second segment of the film 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor. So please join us on Thursday, July 23rd, 2015 at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. Free parking is available in Lot B. And again, that's Thursday, July 23rd at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And now here's an interesting news item. Apparently, the Department of Defense has been assisting movies. Shortly after World War II, the U.S. Department of Defense began formally involving themselves in Hollywood. Since then, they've been involved in hundreds of productions. But until now, we didn't know exactly how many or precisely which films did or did not bear the touch of the Department of Defense. But in a response to a recent FOIA request, the DOD provided a list, and it included The Perfect Storm, The Jackal, What Price Glory, to name just a few. They've also been involved in TV programs, and American Idol is one of them. To learn more about this, you can go to the website spyculture.com, where you can have access to the 1,400-page military document, including all of this information. And again, the website is spyculture.com. 9/11 Wake Up Call is produced at the University of Hartford, WWUH 91.3 FM, and airs Wednesdays at noon and again at 8 p.m. It also airs on WESU at Wesleyan University in Middletown on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. And the shows are archived at radioforall.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.